Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio, Season 1, Episode 3, the show where I take you along on roads I probably shouldn't drive on, to places I probably shouldn't wander, and through stories that probably demonstrate questionable judgment. It's not dramatic or heroic, it's quieter than that, more human. The kind of story that settles into your bones a little. So grab a cup of coffee, or whatever keeps you steady, because this one takes place in the woods, and the woods have a way of telling the truth. Some days in search and rescue are all logistics, radio traffic, and mud in your boots, but every once in a while, one of those days reaches back and takes hold of you. This is one of those days. It started as a missing person incident. They usually do. By the time I arrived, the operation was already in motion. Incident command was running out of an old converted ambulance. The side doors were open and a folding table was pulled up next to where the operations chief had set up the board. Maps, grids, GPS tracks, and a few notes from the earlier Hasty teams. Most of our missions used electronic mapping now. Each team carried a GPS unit and a small printed map that was handed out at staging before they deployed. It wasn't really glamorous, but it worked. All the command positions were already filled, so there wasn't any need for me to wedge in. As a deputy director and a senior instructor, I had the latitude to decide where I'd be most useful. So I assigned myself to QRF, kind of a one-man response unit to verify clues, assist teams that needed direction, respond to medical incidents, and chase down anything that didn't fit the pattern. Honestly, I was being lazy that day. No responsibility leading a team, no need to pile on gear. Truth be told, I preferred it that way. I like to think I'm more efficient alone. No committee, no chatter, just terrain, evidence, and the quiet between radio calls. By afternoon, the state police had sent a helo, which earned a sort of collective groan from the veteran searchers at Incident Command. Their helicopters are fantastic for chasing fleeing suspects down highways, but for finding a missing person in the woods, let's just say the skill set doesn't transfer well. They tend to fly like they're still hunting for a criminal. Big, dramatic sweeps meant to impress and push, not detect a scared, hypothermic missing person tucked under tree cover. They don't even have a trained searcher on board. And even worse, the trooper who requests the asset almost always gives the same baffling order: pull every ground team out of the field while we wait for the bird to show up. It's inefficient and frankly silly to sideline dozens of trained searchers so a helicopter can pretend the forest works like a city block. So when that blue helicopter arrived this time, flying like it was trying to audition for a parade, I already knew the routine. It wasn't there to help. It was there to be seen helping. When the first clue came in, I decided to head out myself. No big plan, no checklist, just a decision to get moving. And that was my first mistake. For reasons I still can't explain, I walked out of staging like I was going to a staff meeting instead of a search. My GPS was at home. I never grabbed a map. I didn't bother to jot down the coordinates being rattled off for the radio. I just listened, nodded, and set off like I actually knew where I was going. I hopped into my Jeep and drove about 5 miles to reach a location that, as it turned out, was only a mile away. At that point, it was less quick reaction force and more slow confusion unit. And there I sat, a senior instructor and deputy director, squinting at my radio like it was some kind of alien artifact, trying to download a GPS app with no bars. Every few minutes, operations keyed up. QRF, are you on scene yet? And I'd answer with a little confidence, almost there. I wasn't almost there, not even close. I've always told new recruits that the field doesn't forgive arrogance. And that day, it forgave me anyway. Experience doesn't make you sharp, it just gives you more creative ways to look like an idiot. Then the radio chatter grew more urgent. The subject had been located, and the canine handler and search team with her needed medical. From the briefing, I already knew who her was. A mother who'd gone missing the night before, kids still at home, family beside themselves. The state police helo tried to make itself useful. Operations radioed that it was hovering over the subject. I looked up and spotted the blue helicopter lumbering across the sky, carving huge ovals over half the county. It wasn't helping. And then, over to my right, I spotted a small cluster of our team's vehicles parked in a driveway. Mud-splattered SUVs, and one I recognized right away, another deputy director's rig. Well, I thought, if they're there, it must be somewhere worth pretending I'm supposed to be. So I pulled in, parked beside them, and decided this was as good an infiltration point as any. I knew where I was, I didn't exactly know where to go. I started down a narrow path that cut between backyards and into the tree line. The sound of traffic faded behind me and the air changed fast, cooler, heavier. There was the smell of crushed acorns and musty earth. Whatever casual attitude I started the day with was long gone now. The moment I left the pavement, it was all business again. I slowed my pace, eyes scanning for signs of the team that had gone in ahead of me. Partial tracks, crushed leaves, branches bent, anything to suggest recent passage. And I found a direction of travel of 4, maybe 5 people. And as I moved deeper, the suburban noise fell away, replaced by the low, steady quiet of the woods. Somewhere out there was the team that found her, and I was supposed to help. And then I heard voices, faint at first. They weren't frantic, just focused, a deliberate cadence you hear when people know what they're doing. A few steps more, and flashes of bright safety yellow broke through the trees, search and rescue uniforms catching the afternoon light. I didn't call out. I never really do. It looked like a few others had already made it before me, medical and another deputy director talking with operations on the radio. I was late, and they didn't need me, so I just shut up and watched. As I stepped into the clearing, I took in the scene quickly, the organized movement, the quiet communications, the sense of purpose that hangs in the air when a situation's under control but not yet over. A Stokes litter lay open on the ground, straps organized, blankets folded. Each motion by the team was deliberate and clean. And then, there was her. She sat upright, half-supported, sobbing with uneven gasps, apologizing through them, drool running down her chin. Her words were a stream of half-formed guilt and confusion. Every few seconds, she would beg for forgiveness from people who hadn't asked for any. "I'm so sorry, my kids, I didn't mean." The words came out in fragments, swallowed by sobs. I didn't know it then, but she had been like this since they first reached her. Not just upset, frantic, inconsolable. They tried to get her to focus, simple questions, direct eye contact. She couldn't track, couldn't stay with any one voice for more than a few seconds. She was there, but not reachable yet. The team stayed composed. And then I felt like I wasn't lost anymore. That's when I understood why I was there. They didn't need another pair of hands. They had that covered. What they needed seemed to be presence. As I looked at her, something in me tightened. Maybe it was the way she was fighting to pull herself back together, desperate to steady herself for her kids. For a moment, I saw my own wife in her, strong but worried, apologizing for breaking under a weight no one could carry alone. I recognized that look. She was asking too much of herself. And it hit closer than I expected, not because it was dramatic, but because it was familiar. Stress, exhaustion, holding too much for too long. Every family has a version of that. This mom didn't need another rescuer in a helmet. She needed someone to see her, to remind her this wasn't the end of the story, that she still had it together. She just needed a hand right now. The canine team hadn't found her exactly. One of the flankers had simply called her name. She whispered back in a single hoarse voice, "Hello?" I asked our on-scene medic for her condition. He was a physician assistant in real life, sharp and calm. I trusted his medical judgment completely. But as he ran through his assessment, vital, swelling, mechanism of injury, I realized he was focused entirely on what he could measure, not what he could feel. "She fell out of a tree last night," he said. I nodded and turned toward her. She was a young mother, maybe late 20s, yoga pants, light jacket, completely unprepared for a night in the woods. Dan, another deputy director, whispered her story. "She left the house to settle down, get some air. She said she was stressed, climbed into a tree stand, sat for a bit. And when she went to get down, she slipped and fell about 15 feet. Her knee blew out. She's been here since. She said she called for hours before her voice went out." Almost 20 hours alone, 4 of them spent shouting into the dark woods with no reply. So I did what I've learned to do best after years of rescues and mistakes and getting it wrong by focusing just on the mission. I knelt beside her quietly. No commands, no questions, just the stillness she could lean against. Her eyes were red and glassy, her breath jagged. "Hey," I said softly. "Looks like you've been through some shit, haven't you?" She froze, surprised. Her shoulders eased. "Yeah," she breathed. "Yeah, I have." I nodded. "Well, you've done something most people couldn't do. You fell 15 feet, blew out your knee, spent the night out here alone, and you're still talking to us, so that's pretty tough." She gave a shaky laugh, half cry, half exhale. "You're tougher than you think," I said. The crying stopped, and the air shifted. Behind me, the team was quiet, watching, disciplined, competent. But this was something different. This was a moment that asked for connection, not command. I touched her shoulder gently. "What do you say we give you a ride out of here? Get you in the blanket and let someone take care of you for a change?" That got a little grin. Her breathing steadied. "You look like you've been caring a lot lately," I added. "It's high time you get carried out by the best search and rescue team in the state. You ready to be spoiled a bit?" She smiled, a little flicker of appreciation, maybe even relief. They settled her into the litter, water, snack, steady hands. And then we lifted. That's when I noticed the ambulance crew, two paramedics who'd hiked all the way in with the rest of us. I chuckled. Well, look at you. You came all the way out here. Good on you. That's a hardcore paramedic crew. They smiled, a little sheepish. She thanked them. As we carried her out, I pointed toward them and said, that right there, those folks, that's an honor for them to make the trek into the woods. Smiles all around. We rotated through, carrying her over down logs and narrow stands of trees, the stokes creaking softly, our boots snapping twigs and crushing leaves as we worked through the final stretch. I watched the team I helped train, doctors, IT techs, scientists, office workers, even an IRS agent, all of them volunteers. Everyday people who showed up for strangers. People who came here to help others. And somewhere along the way found themselves changed a little too. And for a moment, watching them work, I realized I wasn't leading them anymore. I was just lucky enough to be a part of them. We carried her through the last stretch of woods, the trees thinning until the ambulance lights flickered through the branches. The paramedics helped us set down the beat-up old stokes, and together we lifted her onto the gurney. It looked almost elegant in comparison, smooth edges, polished aluminum, a handoff from one world to another. I stepped up to the door and rested a hand on the frame. Good luck, I told her. Keep pushing. You've already done the hard part. She smiled faintly. The door closed. The latch clicked. That evening, I was back at work in regular life. Meetings, economics, expedition planning, same rhythm, no woods, no mud. A few days later, during a meeting, our HR director read an email from the woman we'd rescued. She wanted to thank the team for the professionalism, the kindness, and the difference that we made in her outlook on life. And that's as far as I heard. I got up, walked out, and sat in the quiet of the sheriff's department lobby. Just sat there, thinking about that evening in the woods, the smell of crushed acorns, the sound of her voice breaking, and the handful of people who carried a stranger out of the dark. Maybe that's what we really do out there, carry people a little farther than they can go on their own. And you know, we all carry more than we admit. Stress, worry, exhaustion, fear, whole invisible backpacks full of things no one sees. And every once in a while, life knocks us out of the tree stand, sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively. But if there's one thing I think that day showed me, it's this. You don't have to hold everything alone. You don't have to walk every mile by yourself. Eventually, if you let them, the right people will show up with quiet, careful hands and carry you just a bit farther. And maybe, someday, you'll get the chance to carry someone else. Thanks for listening. Take care of yourself and take care of each other.